Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, our culture of excess. A psychologist talks about how America lost self-control and why we need to redefine success. Then, scandal and silence. Why some misdeeds become scandals and others don't, and how they affect our society. America has entered the age of excess, according to our next guest. Driven by a maddening quest for perfection, technology, deregulation, and a superficial and often inaccurate mass media, our national psychology has become increasingly narcissistic, he says. That is leading to a culture of cheating, lying, reckless behavior, which has crashed the economy and continues to wreck lives in the national fabric. The emerging nation of narcissists has more consequences should the spiral continue, making a world that accepts cheating and lying as a way of life. Jay Slosar is a psychologist, professor of psychology, and author of The Culture of Excess, How America Lost Self-Control, and Why We Need to Redefine Success. Welcome, Jay Slosar.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Why don't we start with you're a psychologist, and not all of our listeners are, so perhaps we can start with a definition of narcissism, and what are the characteristics of this?
Right. Well, it is, in the formal sense, in our diagnostic and statistical manual, it has features for a full-blown diagnosis. I present a continuum in my book that the symptoms are increasing, the aspects of it. And the features include a sense of entitlement, grandiosity, high expectations, a sense of immediacy. With that comes some undesirable features also, such as having less empathy for others and being less forgiving. And while that could lead to a lot of drive and possibly in the workplace, many of our successful people, it's been written for a long time by psychology that many of our CEOs are very top people who reach top spots have high narcissistic features. Of course, there's a downside to it also. And if it's increasing across the culture, kind of like the water level's rising and we have more of these narcissistic features without being fully aware of it.
Well, let's start with the evidence that we're seeing an increase of this kind of person in society. What are we seeing?
Well, the forces that I talk a lot about are the impacting this, the technology and technology and media and extreme capitalism. And we see excess everywhere. Now, there's a technical debate on measuring these narcissistic traits over generations because it is a difficult research endeavor. One researcher has, in her book, Generation Me, has put forth that the scores on the narcissistic personality inventory have increased a good 20 to 30% in today's college students from previous generations. So that the features that we're seeing, we're just hit with them every day, from the excess in purchasing and material things, even lack of self-control and obesity, budgets, whether it's state, federal, our individual budgets, just the stuff everyone, you know, is accumulating. We use a lot of medications. There's tremendous waste everywhere, as in healthcare. Even in prison, we put more people in prison than any other nation does. I mean, we just have excess everywhere from a declining self-control fueled by these higher narcissistic features that make us more impulsive and more entitled.
So you really do think that a lot of what is underlying, I should say, societal ills are really a result of kind of a growing narcissism?
Yes, but it's a cultural phenomenon. What I talk about is that not everybody has a narcissistic personality disorder. It's more a reaction and a response to powerful cultural forces. At one point, I even say, you know, culture trumps personality, that these powerful cultural forces are pushing us in this direction. You know, the quick speed of technology where everything is just so immediate, and you combine that with media and have that 24/7 cycle, and then the third feature, the extreme capitalism that has gone on with so much risk. And I put forth that those forces are cumulative and interactive in how they're influencing our personalities.
How these issues like deregulation and like the technology and the high speed, how do they actually interact with human beings in order to make them more impulsive and more narcissistic, and some other things that you talked about in the book, the anxiety, the expectations of immediacy, losing of patience, the overweightness and the addictions. How does it feed in? I mean, what's the process?
Well, the basic point is that it doesn't apply limits or boundaries, you know, for example, with the deregulation and those aspects. It throws it wide open and anything goes until our behavior rages out of control. In other words, you know, kind of on a continuum, you may be healthy, but then these pressures and lack of boundaries and regulations cause you to go over the top and even possibly commit an illegal activity. A lot of the people arrested for some of these activities were not bad people. You know, they hadn't been criminals before, but they got caught up in the cultural forces where the top is kind of lifted off, and then eventually we take more risk and with less self-control, overdo it in all of the many areas and get into difficulties or health problems.
You know, one of the things that struck me is the bit about cheating and how much young people, students, are cheating and admitting to it and lying and believing that they have to cheat and lie in order to succeed in society.
Right.
And I wonder if, in fact, that is the phenomenon more than anything else. Is this
kind
of...
Well, that certainly is, as I put it, where it's at in terms of the psychological conflict. You know, in the chapter where I cite a lot of the data on surveys of teens and young people who, you know, have to admit that to get ahead, to do well, to be successful, they've got to be manipulative and lie at times. Yet, when asked about their own character, they rate it very, very highly. So, in other words, my character is terrific and great, but on a day-to-day basis, I do have to manipulate, lie, cheat, and steal to survive and to make it. So, you know, that seems like such an obvious conflict, but that's kind of the way culture in the world is. Now, there's probably always been that way to some extent. What I'm kind of saying is that, you know, like that water level again, it's just getting worse and worse to the point where it really does affect your sense of self. If I'm walking around and saying that I'm, you know, I'm great, I'm terrific, and this and that, yet in fact my behavior doesn't match that, well, that's quite a conflict.
Yeah, I think the question that really is raised, and you played with it in your book in this chapter about the cheating, deals with how does a person maintain ethics and character and still be successful in today's business environment or in today's political environment?
That's right.
How do we answer that?
It gets down to real strength of character and leadership skills, you know, to stand out, the ability to withstand the big waves going, you know, and stand up and go against.
But as you said, culture trumps personality.
Yeah, it's very, very hard at this point. And it really does take, I think, a fuller awareness of it and some kind of hitting the bottom point where you say, wait a minute, enough already, and you start to take a more declarative, direct position and realize the kind of big wave that's sweeping over you and pull yourself out of it. Of course, some people are jolted out of that after they get into trouble or after they are exposed, so to speak. And then they pull themselves out of that. We've had so much of that. I'm hoping that we'll hit that point and people will, you know, turn around in the same way that when we had the Great Recession, it forced people to start saving money. Our savings rate for people was like 1 or 2%, you know, far less than other nations. And in 2007, it actually went below zero. It was negative. In other words, people were spending more than they were making. Well, after the recession hit, the savings rate now has gone up to 4 or 5%. And, of course, that's good. In other words, simply a reaction to the big crash.
You talked a bit about issues related to super capitalism, issues related to perfectionism, mm-hmm. and then something you call a false society. Mm-hmm. How are these related?
They are different tracks. In the sense of the super capitalism, we just see, take the hedge funds, for example, they haven't been regulated, and we did away with certain rules that contributed to the Wall Street crash. It's again that out-of-control aspect that finally crashes and gets us into trouble. What happens is I think we get caught in such a way, in such an intense way, we get very perfectionistic. and driven. We've got to make this go. And you have some success or big money that's more and push. And this drive filters down even to our younger people. And so we're seeing more of an aspect of a real drivenness of perfectionism. And even I mentioned that statement that we sometimes hear even in politics. I just cringe when I hear it. Failure is not an option.
But is it perfectionism or is it something else? Because if it was really perfectionism, wouldn't the cheating issue not be so prevalent?
No, the perfectionism becomes so driven that you cheat and can't admit to it. The perfectionism is a very rigid position where you also become unaware of the cover-ups and the things. And then the bad part of it is that when you do get caught, you are so exposed and so vulnerable, it can even lead to an abrupt act of self-destruction and a failure. In my paper that I had talked about in the book, you know, I presented it at Quantico to law enforcement personnel because they have always had a high rate of suicide. And I made the connection that, you know, these are perfectionistic people thinking often, you know, very driven and in a right-wrong kind of manner. And when they make a mistake, they can't handle it. It's kind of like the bigger you are, the harder you fall. So the very successful, driven person, success after success, then encounters a failure, and it's like falling off a big cliff. And they can even at that point commit an abrupt act of self-harm.
Can you talk a bit about the media? What do you think the role of media is in creating this false society?
Well, the problem is, you know, to the often heard statement, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, we know from research that bad is stronger than good, as the researchers put it, that bad events, negative talk about someone, complaints, are remembered and incorporated far more readily than nice things or good things. And just in general, overall, the proliferation of the media, there's this intensity for really negative, bad things, in-your-face things. By the way, I was coming into the office and I had the news on. There's a car chase thing going on, you know, and I'm sure it's on the TV showing some guy being followed. What's the point of that? We call attention to things like kidnappings and school shootings, and we have a red alert, things on kidnappings. Well, this sounds really good, but on the other hand, it induces such an anxiety and fear level across society that people change their lifestyles. They don't want their kid to go play in the park, or they're going to drive them to school, even though in the actual logic and data of it all is that kidnappings and school shootings have not increased. They're not on the increase and more of a problem than they were before. We're just heightened in anxiety about them. And so I think bad is stronger than good, as I put it, is really impacting us.
So let's wrap this into where you think we should go. Part of your subtitle is Why We Need to Redefine Success. And in your book, you talk about changing from a generation me to a generation we. How do we get there from here?
Well, not easily, and it's not going to happen quickly. These are powerful forces, and it's really going to take a good bit of change in time. It's first, as I mentioned before, the boundaries and regulation. I think we really have to get back to that, both with dealing with young children growing up, but also our culture and environment, too. You know, there's an old saying in family systems therapy, a child cannot develop and grow without limits and boundaries. And, of course, if those boundaries are too tight and rigid, that's not good. If they're too loose, that's not good. So the difficult part is finding that proper middle region. But the same is true of our economy and rapidly developing capitalism, what I've called out-of-control capitalism. There need to be boundaries and regulations in order for it to grow. And we're still resisting that at the cultural and political level, but that would really be essential for coming just down the line and shaping our behavior, because we will respond well to as adequate boundaries and regulations. And then the other part is certainly how we measure success. And we're always talking about the GDP. You know, I did look at that group you told me about, Redefining Progress, you know, which has very similar measures for trying to measure success, not by quantity, but by quality. The UN has developed some indices for what's going on in a community, ranging from healthcare to resources and things. And these types of indices should be talked about and presented and discussed much more than simply the amount of things that we buy, which is all that the GDP reflects. I like to ask some people about the GDP. You know, like in 2007, it was awfully high, but how much of that GDP was due to false or bad mortgage loans? If we take that out, then what happens? And then the other thing, I think, is reducing screen media time in terms of particularly for younger children. The National Academy of Pediatrics talks about less than...
When you say screen media,
You mean off a screen.
Okay.
You know, we use that broader term now to include not just TV and computers, but even all the phones and texting and all those things. Just reduce that, particularly with younger kids, and really emphasize what a lot of professionals have been putting forth lately, that the younger person, the child, has time for free play, free unstructured play. That is so important for natural creativity. Everything's kind of programmed and given to the child, and they're getting all sorts of things off the screen media rather than having their own free play, creative, unstructured play.
Well, Jay Slosar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jay Slosar is the author of The Culture of Excess, How America Lost Self-Control, and Why We Need to Redefine Success. When we come back, scandal and silence, why so many scandals go unnoticed, why some become national stories, and how this phenomena affects our society. Next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What makes some misdeeds rise to the level of scandal, while others fade out, hardly noticed? Why is it that the same type of transgressions are treated differently at different times? And might this differential treatment affect our politics, our policies, and society? With us are three experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and international affairs at the George Washington University and author of numerous books, including Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and his latest, Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Brendan Nyhan is also with us. He is professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media, and the Truth. Sigurd Ahlern also joins us from Stockholm. He is professor of journalism studies at the University of Oslo and Stockholm University and author of Scandalous, The Mediated Construction of Political Scandals in Four Nordic Countries. So you all study this scandal and mass media, this intersection between scandal, mass media, and public understanding of scandal. I thought we should start with a context about why it's important for the public to understand these scandalous issues and why it's important for scholarship to delineate what it all means for us. Bob Entman, why don't you lead us with why this is important?
Perhaps the primary duty of a media in a democracy is to alert the public to what their leaders are up to. And when leaders are misbehaving, if they're acting in an incompetent fashion, a corrupt fashion, it seems to me there's essentially nothing more important for the media to tell us about. And when those things happen, sometimes call them scandals. The other thing that media need to do is hold the officials accountable. So it's not merely a matter of alerting the public to the misconduct, but making sure that enough information is out that the public and other leaders will pursue the matter until the guilty party, if he or she is guilty, is held accountable.
So in essence, there's an accountability issue, but there's also a democratic issue attached. Would you say that's the case?
Absolutely. In countries where corruption is ignored or papered over, those places are less functioning democracies.
Brendan Nyhan.
Well, I agree with Bob. It's a hugely important issue. You just have to look at recent political history in this country. Three of the last eight presidents were forced out of office or had their tenure seriously threatened by scandal, Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton. And scandal has frequently dominated the national political discussion and debate. In place of more substantive policy issues. So there's two sides to this coin. On the one hand, as citizens, we want our leaders to be held accountable when there is misconduct. But on the other hand, there may be cases where allegations of misconduct get wide publicity, even though they're not well substantiated. And we've seen examples of both of those. And the media seems to get it wrong, at least as often as they get it right. So it is very important to think about how this process works.
So then we have this aspect of false alarms and false accusations that we should get into. Sigurd Alrun, is there anything you'd like to add to this context?
I agree that political scandals often function as a sort of political control. They inform us. They are necessary and healthy for democracy. And I basically accept that argument. But I think it also would be naive to interpret any mediated scandal as a strengthening of democratic processes. You have superficial scandals. You have more irrelevant scandals. So we have also to ask what type of scandals are important.
And that would get us right into the substance of the research that the three of you are doing. It seems that there are two general myths in the United States about mass media and scandal, and both seem wrong according to your research. The first deals with, say, the Watergate scandal as evidence of the media's vigilance. But then there's the second narrative that mass media focuses on only scandal that doesn't really have major public implications but are really private matters like sex scandals. Let's start with your core findings and what it says about these myths.
First of all, the idea that the media are hungering for scandal in any form is truly misleading. It implies that, first of all, that the media are in control of whether there's a scandal or not, and that really isn't the case. It ignores the fact that in many cases, perhaps most cases, knowledge that is fairly well rooted in confirmed fact is often ignored, even when it has to do with sex scandals, and most certainly when it has to do with much more serious substantive abuses of power, incompetence, and corruption. So I think it's awfully important that we understand that the media are not vigilantly on guard against either all trivial scandals or all important scandals. It's a much more complicated process determining whether we have a scandal or not that has relatively much less to do with what the person actually did and much more to do with things like which party is more skilled, which political party has the most incentive to promote a scandal. And when you have a situation, for example, where neither party in the United States or none of the parties in multi-party democracies are interested in promoting a scandal, you won't really get one, even if the media want one.
So then it brings up the role of the political elites, the elected officials, rather than the journalists as sitting in the driver's seat. Is that how your research has panned out?
Yes, I think for the most part, if the leaders, if at least some important leaders, aren't really interested in promoting a scandal over a matter, it won't happen, no matter how serious the underlying misconduct is.
Brendan Nyhan, is this also what your research has found?
I largely agree with Bob on this. I've described scandal as a co-production, typically in the case of U.S. presidents, between the media and the opposition party. It's certainly true that the media can't create scandal on its own in most cases, but there's often a synergistic relationship with the political party when people, at least some people, as Bob said, in that party want to create a scandal. So a good example of when this doesn't happen is the period after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, when many, if not most, Democrats at the national level were wary of going after President Bush, who still had high approval ratings and a wartime president aura. And so allegations that might have turned into scandals in other contexts typically fizzled and died because the opposition party was wary. But it also was a case where the media, too, was wary of challenging a wartime president who had this aura around him.
And is that how it occurs in Europe as well, Sigurn Alrun?
In the Nordic countries in Europe, we have another media system, another political system, and countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark just some decades ago were looked upon as more or less a scandal-free zone. But that has changed, and our research shows that in the last decade, there has been a really large increase in the media reports about different types of scandals. But when you look into it, only around 40% of national political scandals was directly concerned with politics. More than 60% were personal acts in a more or less private role or a personal act in a sort of political role. But it were very few, relatively few political scandals, which really was about politics and important political questions.
Let's use some specific examples that our audiences can relate this to. Bob Entman, you looked at several different kinds of scandals in your book and found that, for example, media are very inconsistent with even the sexual misconduct. They have gone after some, such as Bill Clinton, and they haven't gone after others, including John McCain and George H.W. Bush. Why the discrepancy?
The discrepancy has a lot to do with the particular alignment of forces at a particular time. In the case of Clinton, you had an opposition party, the Republicans, who were determined to undermine him and use every lever they could, and he gave them quite a wonderful opportunity with his actual behavior, which was confirmable by scientific analysis. In the case of the senior Bush, John McCain, Bob Dole, you had somewhat less direct or scientific evidence, although I dare say you had enough evidence to convict in most courts, and yet the media sat on this information, gossiped about it privately, but never blew it up into a scandal. I think in each of those cases, you may argue that it wasn't the media's fault. In fact, maybe the media did the right thing. The real problem is the inconsistency. What that means is that the media intervene in the outcome of elections. So that, for example, in 1996, they admitted after the election that they sat on information about Bob Dole's infidelity, which in fact was quite clearly known in Washington among the insiders. And they did so for this kind of murky reason about the long time ago, and we don't want to invade his privacy. Well, if that were a consistent standard, I think it would be good, actually. But it's not. That didn't hold for Bill Clinton. It may or may not hold in the future. It's the inconsistency that I think is particularly troublesome. And it also means that when, as in the case of Clinton, one of the parties is determined to get this information out, it may get out and distort the electorate's view of their politicians. Because let me tell you that the rate of these kinds of things among politicians in Washington is very high.
This also occurred with very substantive issues beyond sexuality, which you noted. The New York Times sat on a George W. Bush, I think you called them potential scandals, dealing with spying on Americans. How do we explain this?
Well, in that case, I think you had the national security claim, which presidents, when they can use it, it's usually pretty effective. Indeed, I think it helped George W. Bush in quite a few contexts. But here's another example with George W. Bush. He engaged in insider stock trading while his father was president. It was investigated by the regulatory authorities, and they found insufficient evidence to pursue the matter. Now, if you compare that to what happened under Clinton, where there was, as we all know, many millions of dollars expended for years and years on an investigation of every possible detail, which ultimately led to Monica Lewinsky, you see the level of inconsistency that if a president's business dealings prior to being president are relevant to the public, then they should be consistently relevant. And in that case, in essence, the Bush family covered up what George W. Bush had done quite successfully. And you mentioned Watergate. Let me just say that the biggest problem with Watergate is that people assume that that is the typical political scandal instead of what it is, which is the unique political scandal that actually did lead to the fall of a president because of corruption.
Brendan Nyhan.
A couple of things. The discussion we're having, I hope, underlines for your audience the extent to which scandals aren't simply a function of whether there's evidence of misconduct or credible allegations, which has been a subtext of a lot of what we're talking about, but I think it's important because that's typically how people think about scandal. The other point that we haven't quite brought up is the way in which an allegation is consistent with a view of a politician, a stereotype, is often quite powerful. So Clinton had a persona as a womanizer or flirtatious or someone who had problems in his marriage. And so the allegations against him fit with that persona, which had been brought to the surface during his primary campaign with the Jennifer Flowers allegations. So the Monica Lewinsky allegations were already been legitimized, whereas Dole was injured in World War II quite substantially. John McCain was seen as a war hero, and it was less consistent with the public personas of those men.
There's one other piece, Brendan Nye, that I wanted to ask you about before we go back over to look at the European examples. One of the things you wrote about was how these scandals get buried with other pressing stories and how politicians use these more pressing issues to avoid the scandals becoming publicized.
I think this is an important piece of when scandals happen. We've talked about the strategy of a party going after someone on a scandal or not. But there are also things that are outside of your control. In the case of my research, I've looked at things like, does a hurricane hit? Is there a mass shooting? Is there an earthquake? Things that dominate the news out of nowhere. But you can think of lots of other examples. When there are big events in the news, it displaces other stories. And sometimes the media's attention is elsewhere. They're devoting their resources to covering other stories, and they're not as interested. In other cases, the media are bored. They're sitting around looking for something to write about. This is the classic story of the slow news period that is often told about the summer, but it can happen almost any time of year when the political media really has nothing to write about. And in those circumstances, an allegation which might get ignored in a different context can take off.
Sigurd Allern, let's take a look at how this is playing out in Europe. What are some specific examples?
There's a lot of differences in Europe. If you look at the UK, you have had scandals concerning what you call sex scandals. You have politicians with mistresses and so on. The same conduct in France is no scandal. It has been a change of climate because of the last affair. But in most European countries, you have all the norms, which can make the type of mediated scandals different. In Nordic countries, you normally do not write a lot about politicians' sexual affairs, and you did not write about politicians with problems with alcohol, but there has been a change in the last decade. Well-known example in the Nordic countries is Finland, where it was possible for a politician 2-3 decades ago to have grave alcohol problems without this being a scandal or looked upon as a scandal. But today the climate, the norms have changed. So the demands concerning a politician's conduct are others than before, and therefore such affairs can be scandalized in another way. So the norms are changing and influencing what's talked about and what's looked upon as scandals. In many cases, political scandals are not built upon great revelations, muckraking, a lot of investigating journalistic works. It's based on leaks. It's based on leaks from different political actors who use scandalizing in the political process. Most journalists, when we discuss scandals, are referring to, also referring in Europe and the Nordic countries, to Watergate. But I agree that the Watergate example is also for European journalism quite untypical.
Bob Entman.
I was just going to ask Professor Allern about the degree to which there is consistency now. Are they consistently going after every sex scandal, or is it more depending on different rivalries and different political interests?
I do not think they are consistently going after sexual scandals. There have been a few scandals, and in Norway, to an example, several of them have been about the opposition right-wing party called the Progressive Party, which has been a sort of underdog in the political system. So I think there is clear differences between how politicians are treated, yes.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle. We are analyzing why some transgressions become scandals while others don't, and how it affects our society and politics. There are some things that all three of you are pointing to, and some of this has been in your work already, and that is that it seems like some of the determinants are A, that the scandal is easy to go after and easy to confirm. It's either been laid out already by the opposition party, or there are hearings being held, as in the case of Watergate, which, Bob Entman, you have written about and talked about quite a bit. Very easy to point a finger to somebody, so there's a personalization element to it. But it seems there's also another piece that is not being talked about, which is political power. Bob, you wrote about this too, and I wanted to see if you might address it, where the more powerful people tend to be scrutinized perhaps the most carefully.
It's interesting because I think the stereotype of the media tends to be that the more powerful you are, the more vulnerable you are, and the more careful you have to be. But my research suggests that because of some of the things we've already talked about, you really can't make that claim. And in fact, you might argue that the more powerful you are, in many cases, the less likely you are to be held accountable. So, for example, if a president is very popular and to the point that the opposition party may be reluctant to attack very hard, that translates into a protection for the incumbent, even if certain allegations arise. And the second point about this that I think is very important for your audience and Americans to understand is that frequently the most serious corruption may involve institutions. For example, let's say the Federal Reserve Bank and the Securities and Exchange Commission, thinking about the horrible economic meltdown and the numerous crimes that were committed by major banks and the lack of regulation and I think conflicts of interest between people who were in government but who wanted to have a career in banking and vice versa. All of that has yielded, as everyone in the audience knows, no scandal. There has been nobody who's gotten in trouble or been held accountable for this. And in that case, you have to say, of course, the cause of this misconduct is sort of the entrenched way the system operates. In that sense, it is the very most powerful institutions and the most deeply rooted causes of the problems that may yield corruption that are the least vulnerable to truly being revealed and held accountable.
I think that at least our research in the Northern Europe show that most scandals are about or limited to individual personal or moral transgressions, and very few of them involve institutional questions or structural questions or institutions. And you also have, I think, several examples in the Nordic countries showing that relatively grave accusations and in some ways attempts for scandals concerning important members of government, like the Swedish foreign minister, Carl Bildt, with his relations to oil company, with interests in Africa. There has been a lot of debates. He's sort of untouchable in the Swedish government. He's too important. It's quite impossible that Carl Bildt should lose his position as long as this government is in power. But if you are a minor member of government, if you're not so important, if you are a minor politician, relatively speaking, well, then you much more easily will lose your position if it's a coalition government, if you fall under smaller parties and so on. We have seen that in Sweden, we have seen that in Denmark, we have seen the same thing in Norway. And in general, we also found that around the double, if we compare men and women in government positions, and when women in government positions are being scandalized, around 60% of the female members of government scandalized had to go. They lost their position. Around 60% of the men kept their position. They were just criticized. So there is a difference. And if you're important, if you have a real strong position, the consequences will be another than if you are a minor member of government or not so important politician.
Bob Entman, that sounds very similar to some of the things that you found in terms of power, and that the people who are least powerful or a few steps down from the person of power tend to be the ones that take the fall. But there's one other piece that I wanted you to address, and that is you mentioned that cover-ups often work, and that's why they're practiced. And number two, there's been a practice of going after media themselves, such as in the case of Dan Rather and others. Can you talk about how that offense's defense is affecting media's ability to expose scandal?
I think it's important to realize, and this is very much contrary to the conventional wisdom, that cover-ups do work. We often hear that the best advice for a politician accused of wrongdoing is to get all the facts out right away and just lay them all out and apologize. Well, sometimes they do that, and sometimes it works. But quite often, they do engage in cover-ups, and quite often, they work. It's only if you assume that the media have this extraordinary degree of investigative power does it make sense not to try a cover-up if that looks like it might succeed. As an example, think about how when the issue arose of Mitt Romney's tax returns, there's a lot of writing about this in the media early on that said, well, he's going to have to release them anyway, so why doesn't he just get it all out now, early in the campaign? And I predicted, no, he would cover them up, and that was his best strategy. So we really need to understand the notion that cover-ups don't work is wrong. They often do work, and they are a good strategy, which means for the average citizen that you're not finding out about a lot of potential scandals.
Brendan Nyhan, would you agree?
Well, this gets into the difficulty of studying scandal, which is agreeing on what a scandal is or what a potential scandal is. It's often very difficult. It involves subjective judgments about what is or is not misconduct, what is or is not inappropriate, what actions are or are not justified. And those are very hard for us to agree on, even just as scholars. And then for the larger public, which is, of course, very polarized, especially the people who follow politics closely, it's very hard to agree on what is or should be a scandal. So it is difficult to say that something should have been a scandal and wasn't. I think we can agree, though, in some cases, that here's a candidate that looks like something that could have been a scandal if things had broken differently. Maybe we don't agree normatively on whether the action actually was misconduct or not, but we can say, I can imagine this being a scandal. And that may be unsatisfying, especially when it comes to people we don't like. We're often quick to rush to those normative judgments that they did something wrong. And that's part of what makes scandal so powerful, but it also makes it so hard to figure out what should be a scandal or not.
That brings up three things, really. One is your notion that the mass media professionals act like juries or act like chaplains or judges in their framing of the issue, having it either rise to the level of a scandal or not. But it also brings up two other really important points. One is the scandalization of things that may not have anything to do with a true scandal, such as if you watch some of the very conservative television and radio, and they have tried to scandalize climate science, calling it a fraud. And there is a healthy population who actually think that climate scientists are perpetuating a fraud.
That's actually an excellent example, the so-called Climategate, which was trumped up out of very flimsy evidence and yet was enormously successful as a political tactic, because you see that after that scandal arose, the amount of denial of climate change actually went up. Now, there may be other forces behind that change, but I think there's substantial evidence that that was a successful political strategy. And it again points to the fact that there is not a close connection between the underlying facts of the matter and whether or not and the degree to which something is framed as a scandal. In that case, you know, we have pretty strong scientific evidence that there is climate change, and the idea that thousands of scientists around the world are conspiring stretches the imagination, to say the least. Nonetheless, it was successfully used to the point that a good amount of the media coverage, not all of it, but a good amount of the media coverage, at least for some time after that, felt obligated to sort of treat the climate change deniers on an equal footing with the scientists who say it is happening.
Sigurd Nylund.
Well, I think that in Northern Europe, at least, there is a relatively strong consensus concerning the dangers of climate change. But of course, you have others and some oppositional voices about this. But we have another problem, I think, because the basic idea in our part of the world, at least in the Nordic region, is that it's possible for rich countries to buy themselves out of it, to buy climate quotas. and use the money to let poorer nations solve the problem, so to say, so we can go on like before. And I would say, coming from Norway, oil-rich and oil and gas production country, it's very difficult to mobilize real investigating journalism attacking some of the interests of the big oil companies and the state, who itself is one of the large oil exporters in the world. So in such affairs, journalism will meet very strong forces. It's difficult to make revelations that really count. And I think that's a general problem here, that critical journalism needs a lot of knowledge, it needs a lot of resources. And if you don't have them, and if you're under a commercial enterprise, it's difficult to get such resources when the investigations and what you do is opposite of business interests.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about political scandals. There are three last things I'd like to address. One pertains to things that never really get to the level of scandal, like the issue of torture that we saw in the Bush administration, and specifically when the Obama administration released the document showing they'd tortured, not to get confessions, but to falsely connect Saddam Hussein to 9/11, and why that never rose to the level of scandal. Bob Antman, why didn't this very serious issue rise to the level of a scandal?
I think at least two reasons. First of all, both parties are somewhat implicated in this problem. There's evidence that certain people in the Democratic Party were briefed, and so any thorough investigation could get both parties in trouble. Second of all, it was really Obama's call when he became president not to look backward, but only to look forward. And I think a part of that decision was based on the need to appear tough on terrorism. Nobody was going to outflank Obama on the right by saying he wasn't tough on terrorism. So among his decisions was, I'm not going to, you know, go over this torture business anymore. So there, it's just another one of many that we've talked about, examples of where a media report and even stuff that is confirmed factually doesn't necessarily in any way mean that there will be a scandal of any significance.
Brendan, again, I'm going to point to you because you've looked at Obama and his particular avoidance of scandal.
To a large extent, it's been the dog that hasn't barked of the Obama administration. There's been relatively little scandal under President Obama. There's a few different reasons that I've suggested why that might be. The first was the economy has struggled, so the Republicans have had a core issue. One of the reasons potentially that Republicans pursued Clinton so aggressively on scandal was, especially in his second term, was that the economy was doing quite well, and so they were looking for alternative grounds to criticize him. The other thing, we mentioned personality and consistency with narratives, and Obama's personal background as an adult that he wrote about in his book, he has very few allegations against him personally, and so things didn't line up with a stereotype or perception of his administration. And the final thing is just there were a huge number of big news events during the first couple years of Obama's administration, not just the economic collapse, but the oil spill in the Gulf, the Arab Spring. There have just been a series of large news events that have kept people busy and kept the media's focus elsewhere.
Now, there were a couple of attempted scandals. One was Fast and Furious and one was Solyndra, but they kind of fizzled out.
Yeah, they might have gotten just over the threshold if they were briefly considered as scandals in the national media, but they certainly never registered at the level of the big scandals that we think of over the past 20 or 30 years. They're kind of simmering below the surface.
Good Alden here. I want just to add that sometimes what happens in the U.S. and things the United States are responsible for in the world, well, maybe it's not treated as a political scandal in the U.S., but sometimes it's certainly treated like a political scandal in, like, the European and Nordic media. They are begrudged the questions about torture, the lies about weapons of mass destruction and so on. There has been really a lot of critiques. I have, there is a large difference. It has, of course, with the political things to do. And I think if the election the American presidential election was in Europe, Obama would have got 85% of the vote.
Sigurd Alern, you had mentioned in your own work this very important role of the norms of a society, kind of the values that they hold dear, because scandal is, of course, a violation of those norms. And news media tend to focus on violations of norms. But then there's a role that news media play in setting up those norms and values as well. So how do you see this playing out in a comparison of Europe versus the United States?
The social media is important, but I think that concerning politics, at least as we have experienced it, social media mostly have a political role when the traditional media, newspapers, televisions, channels, and so on, pick up what's going on there. Very few of the debates and what's happening in the social media have a sort of direct impact on the large public sphere. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, let's toss it back over to Bob Entman then to take a look at this in the context of the social media.
One interesting point that Professor Alern raises is that there may be the paradox that there's more scandal reporting in Europe about what's going on in America than there is in America. So the citizens of Europe may have better information about some of the corruption that goes on in the United States or the misconduct than Americans themselves. And surely that is not the ideal situation. Normally we would want, you know, the country's own media to do a pretty good job. On the other hand, we've talked about all the ways in which it's difficult for the media to do that. I tend to think that social media can help to surface an issue. They can possibly give it a little more energy to be on the radar screens of politicians and journalists. But ultimately, the main gatekeepers remain really a handful of elite media in Washington and New York. And if they don't decide that they are going to go into this and cover it repeatedly and prominently, it doesn't really matter very much what's in the social media. I gave an example in the book, the John Edwards sexual escapades, which had all of these incredibly salacious and newspaper-selling kinds of details, including a love child. This was ignored by the mainstream media for months and months, even though it had scandal written all over it. That would be an example of something that if you were looking at the right blogs and at the right Twitter feeds and so on, you could actually find out about it. But politically, it was the tree falling in the forest and no one was there.
There are two big questions lingering. One kind of ties back to how we opened this discussion, which is what is the effect on the public? And I wonder if when mass media do not adequately cover these scandals, if we are then building kind of a culture of corruption.
I certainly wouldn't go that far. I think people in Washington are very concerned about being exposed. You may not turn into a scandal, but there are lots of people who've had their reputations ruined and ended up in jail or spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, even when they didn't really do anything. So are there ways our system could be improved? Of course. Is our political system perfect? No. But this is a difficult case because, again, it's very hard to agree on what the corruption is that we should be covering and how we should be holding officials accountable. And those are very hard lines to draw. I think the media could do a better job, but I wouldn't go so far as to say they're creating a culture of corruption.
Sigurd Alern?
I wouldn't use those words, but still I think that Professor Entman in his book about scandal and silence has some important points concerning the lack of real critical journalism and watchdogs concerning the financial elites, the leading banks, what they do. And when you discover that they have a very negative role concerning the societal economy, they are bailed out. It's a lack of proportion between all the time we use to discuss minor scandals, minor revelation about individual problems and so on, and the lack of concentration of journalistic research and criticism on the important things concerning both the American and other society. I think that's an important point.
Bob Entman.
This problem of failing to track the seriousness of the misconduct, it sounds like this is a problem not only in the United States but in Europe. And the one thing I guess I would ask members of the audience, citizens, to be aware that they really need to think for themselves and not judge whether an individual politician is corrupt or a certain series of actions are scandalous. They have to judge that for themselves rather than waiting for the media to package it as a scandal, because that might not happen. And I'd also ask journalists to be much more self-aware of this problem of calibrating the degree to which they frame something as a scandal and the underlying facts and the seriousness of the impact on the American people. We, I think, would have an improved democracy and a reduction of corruption if that calibration could be brought more into line.
Well, thank you all so much, Bob Entman, Brendan Nyhan, and Sigurd Allern. Thank you all so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and international affairs at the George Washington University and author of numerous books, including his latest, Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Brendan Nyhan is a professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media and the Truth. Sigurd Allern is professor of journalism studies at the University of Oslo and Stockholm University and author of Scandalous, The Mediated Construction of Political Scandals in Four Nordic Countries. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
The Pacifica Radio Archives needs your help so we can restore and preserve another of our 55,000 reel-to-reel tapes in our collection.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand-year-old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow, her tomorrow.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949. I'm